Warriors are not born. Warriors are forged in the crucible of adversity. Warriors without fear are warriors without courage. We are men destroying stigma and stereotypes. We are a band of brothers because in brotherhood there is strength. Our weapons are strength, empathy, and honesty. We are Mental Health Warriors, and this is our voice.
At this point, you're probably saying to yourself, how can I support these guys? Because I love the Mental Health Warriors podcast so much, which is a coincidence because I'm sitting here thinking, man, I should really tell people about how they can support the show. So there's three ways to do it. The simplest and easiest is to share our episodes. So if you connect deeply with what you're hearing, or you know that there's someone in your life that could benefit from the things that we're talking about, share our episode with them. It's a gift to them and it's a gift to us. All you need to do is press share on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. It doesn't matter, but every share helps us spread our message. The second thing is to become a supporter of the show. So navigate on over to patreon.com and pledge to support us per episode. It might be a buck, it might be $2. We appreciate everything. And you can cap it per month. So if we get crazy and start releasing episodes every day and a half, you don't have to worry about that. And if you start to think that we suck and we're not worthy of your financial support, you can cancel your support at any time. And the last thing is, leave us a review and rating on iTunes. That helps people find our podcast, and that helps us help more people, and that is the reason we're doing this. So thank you so much for your support. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Here we go. Man, I'm not sure what to say about Adam Lowry. This is a wild ride, and you're going to need to buckle up before we embark on this journey, because this guy has a different point of view. We're going to go on what's called a cognitive rampage, and it's going to open your eyes to what else is possible. Adam's a mental health counselor, author, host of the Cognitive Rampage podcast, and a mental trainer. He also takes an activist role in treatment reform. This guy's founded the Diagnosis Athlete's Depression and the Integrative Psychological Approach Transrational Structural Behavior Therapy. What the hell is that, you ask? Well, hey, we're going to find out in the conversation we have. But ultimately, he's a father, son, brother, friend, and humanitarian. And he's a teacher and a protector. This guy has a crazy life, violence, addiction, a multi-year wandering sort of a spiritual rampage. And then he came back and he changed his life. He didn't like what he was seeing in the mental health field. He didn't like how people were being treated, how they were being diagnosed, how they were being labeled. So he decided to do something about it. So he got 2 degrees. He published The Cognitive Rampage. He launched a podcast and founded his athlete's depression diagnosis. The idea of cognitive rampage is really speaking, it's almost like a stream of consciousness sometimes, speaking passionately and clearly on social issues connected to mental health and athlete-specific related mental health. But really, what I want you to take away from this episode is there are different approaches and there are different ways of caring about people. And don't take one opinion as gospel like I did. Man, I regret that. I regret not reaching out and looking into the world and seeing what else was possible, not just for myself, obviously, but for Cindy. I applaud Adam for what he's doing. The guy is a fucking hero, and you may not agree with him. You may agree with him. It doesn't matter. The point is that here at the Mental Health Warriors podcast, we are never going to stop looking for people who are trying to make a difference and seeking alternative points of view. So you are armed with the information that you need to make the best choices for yourself and your family. Enjoy the ride because it is going to be a wild one. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Mental Health Warriors podcast. We are really lucky to have Adam Lowry on our episode today, and today we're going to be talking to him about fusing the cognitive, behavioral, social, biological, and philosophical arts and sciences. Okay, man, what does that mean?
Well, I purposely tried to add philosophy in there because all of them go, right? If it's the analogy you're looking at, wait, philosophy doesn't seem to go. but I like to look at all of them as being an artistic or even an artist applied science, right? We have to question and create and hypothesize, and this becomes almost artistic in a way, right? Where you're creating, thinking beyond what science has shown you to begin with, and that's very philosophical. And I'm a believer in the philosophical foundations, if you will, of life, of how we lead, what we believe, etc. But we can't ignore those other implications that are just hard science, biology, environmental, epigenetic influences, etc., that affect us in varying ways. So the idea was, one, writing the book, I wanted to fuse all that together. I was a therapist for a long time, did addiction treatment, etc. And there's just this one singular mode of treatment, really. There's this baseline, right? And I wanted to collect everything, right? And in a lot of practitioners in the field, they usually focus, right? They're cognitive people, they're behavioral people, or they mix the cognitive behavioral sometimes. But we get so focused on the principles of which our foundation is being, is if I'm a behavioralist or if I'm a cognitive practitioner or a 12-step practitioner, right? If these are our approaches, we were getting just pigeonholed of staying there. So I thought they were all right. I thought they all had great influences. And science backed the idea of behavioralism, cognitive, the idea of social influence, all these ideas are provable by science. And we were not applying them, nor really taught them in a way to integrate them all and help someone and really affect change. Because just changing your thoughts can help. Yes, changing your beliefs for sure. But if the environment's not addressed, right? If your biology's not addressed at the same time, if you don't structure all that, you're kind of beating a dead horse there. So it was, one, writing the book began all this, really, was I knew there had to be a different way, right? And I realized all these people are theorists anyway, right? They're just theorizing. And I thought, how cool. It's such a young science and art, if you will, that we can still come up with our own theories, right? We can have our own CBTs, right? We can create our own stuff. And I thought, man, all right, I'm in. And that's where, through the years of treating addiction, I came up with this long-winded theoretical approach called transrational structure behavior theory. And that doesn't sell books or make a cool podcast. So my delivery was rather unorthodox in the treatment groups, etc. I would not sit down and just pass out handouts and everybody read in unison and talk. I wouldn't do that. I would actually give lessons. I would stand up and teach what I was taught in my mental health degree. And then I realized people were grabbing onto lessons and teaching, right? So that kind of birthed the idea. I think one of my patients one time is like, you know, you're forever rampaging when you're trying to help us and teach groups, et cetera. And then I was a cognitive-based practitioner, and the two and two was born, and I wrote this book as the application of transrational structure behavior theory. And a lot of that is based on the idea of questioning self, what we believe, what we've experienced, what we believe is happy, right? What we believe we can do. And this quest for competence is what it became for me. Self-competence, self-revelation. The first edition of the book was very raw and very open about my own self-revelations as I was learning about psychology, plus a 2-year walkabout I had taken, right? I just kind of merged it together. The second edition of the book was more about finding the sciences that were backing the implications that I was writing about and putting it all together in one. And so the podcast became, I want to know. I just want to know, right? I became, like I say in my book, right? Many times we simply concrete what we believe about ourselves, others in the world, right? We just say, this is who I am. This is what I believe concretely. But we lose the curiosity that we had as children when our favorite question, right? Why? Why do I believe that? Why do I think that experience is the reality when I know the power of human plasticity in our perception, right? When we can question those ideas, man, it opened up so much. So this quest for competence, if you will, in myself and the world and others has kind of birthed the podcast, wanting, like you said in the beginning, wanted to talk to amazing people, smart people, learn their theories, what they were doing, kind of in a fast forward 10x version, really.
Well, we're 5 minutes in and my mind is already blown. So, hey, so listen, you said you're a cognitive, based practitioner. So how do you, with my experience with mental health and going through, with my wife went through, I feel like people get quite wedded, like, and you alluded to this, get quite wedded to their own modality, right? Their own beliefs, whether it's a psychiatrist providing medication or a specific practitioner doing a certain modality. So how difficult was it for you to break out of that way of thinking?
Very difficult, man. That's a good question. I almost collapsed in a way mentally, brother. When I was a couple years into the addiction treatment and realized how broken the system is, how we feed the magic pill belief, you know, people want to blame doctors or facilities or the people, but the idea is they're all operating within a destructive system, and it's only getting worse, really. And so as I was operating within a system, I could see it all. I could go, oh, no, this can't be so, right? And I'm being told to practice 12 steps in my group. And, brother, I never had a class on 12 steps ever in my entire psychology schooling. The only time I'd seen 12 steps was when I'd seen a rehab facility myself as a much wilder person. And so I'm forced into this structured way of teaching it, telling people it's a disease, for one. When jury's out really on definitions, right? I don't want to get in semantics, but when you're watching all that, and you know, a book that changed my life was a cognitive practitioner creator, really. I like to call him the godfather of it, but Albert Ellis, who he wrote a bunch of books, but the idea of rational emotive therapy or rational emotive behavior therapy, this dude was just crude, man. I loved him, man. He held no shit back. He was the idea really of taking the cognitive deeper into beliefs and restructuring those and being rational versus irrational. And my mom handed me that book, man, when I was like 22 or something, just in and out of jail once or twice. And I finally sat down and read that book like years later. And I'm like, God, why didn't I read that back then? It hit me so hard. It was A Guide to Rational Living. And he has a couple versions of that. But that was long before I was ever even a therapist, even thought about being a therapist at all. But that cognitive idea, I was like, man, the reality is I'm just creating it. The shit's not even real, right? It was hit me like so hard. And so that became kind of my focus. So as I was going through the master's program, et cetera, I would read beyond. You know, I'd like to say that I didn't read and I didn't study. I trained. I was reading 6 books outside of the realm of the book that we were required to read, right? I was on this quest of self-revelation at the time. So as I broke into all these theorists and approaches and ideas, right, the cognitive side seemed to be the start. You know, it began with what we believe, what we think. And sure, our environments, all these things are crucial. And I'm not saying one is more than the other, but the place that we control mostly and in the immediate is what we think and how we process what we think. And so not being able to apply it freely, all of these amazing techniques I'd read about and learned about and theories, and having to stick to an insurance structured way of treatment. We are a reactive mental health culture. We are a reactive medical health culture, and being forced to practice reactive treatment with 4 tools, and when there's so many amazing concepts and tools and approaches and things we could be using and we just couldn't. That was the difficult part. That kind of really birthed the rampage, man, was I had to get this shit out. I'm like, I'm practicing in this realm that I don't see any help in sight. There's no change. And I'm like, I had to tell somebody. So it started in 2013. In a private practice office with my mentor, Leo D'Annibal, who is the man, on a stupid Ustream laptop camera and just talking. Sometimes I would give my lessons that I was doing in group with people. Sometimes him and I would just talk about treatment. But I noticed I looked really upset. I was pretty angry, and that's how that cognitive rampage kept going, was that idea. And I would work the board late at night, the whiteboard, like John Nash. I write my book, the movie Beautiful Mind, you know, just looking for this original idea, just redoing it, I worked 3 years on TSBT, and still develop it now. But, you know, only coming to the conclusion that there are no original ideas, that we only build off of one another, right? We stand on the shoulders of giants. I believe, I think it's John Campbell said that, but you know, we grow on that and having that theory base, I needed an outlet. I needed to tell somebody, and that's how this all got started, man, was we need to change mental health, and nobody is listening.
That is fucking awesome. Man, I love that. Okay, Brian, if you got a question, jump in, or I'm going to keep going, so you better interrupt.
No, just give her, Jay. I'm enjoying the back and forth here. Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm just blown away by the concept, Adam, that you didn't like what was out there, so you basically said fuck it, and you ran with what you were comfortable with and what you knew, and you came up with a whole new way of looking at mental health. It's just mind-boggling to me.
Well, it was weird, man. I was out in California, and what really sparked it, I mean, I was working on a book at the time. It was called Mastering Life Transitions. I was also kind of peddling a little on the side, little doodling on the side about a second book called Chemical Incarceration. And that's what I was calling addiction treatment, was chemical incarceration. It's trading one drug for another drug, using narcotics to get people off of narcotics, and even the idea of just mental health treatment, period, of the idea of the pill treatment as the first line of defense of reactive nature, if you will, of mental health. And, you know, I was in L.A. by randomness. I kind of went to go meet him, but I ran into Joe Rogan cast. And from there, I let loose, man. I let loose what the addiction treatment was going down. I was generalizing a lot of things, too, about Suboxone and self-harm treatment, all right, that was taken out of context. But for me, that cognitive rampage needed to fucking be said. It needed to be said, and I shit you not, man. I was fired from both of my mental health counseling jobs the next day. Before I even flew back from L.A., I was already fired from both of those jobs.
Wow, that's great. So you broke up a little bit when you were saying Joe Rogan. So can you tell me about that interaction again?
If I lost you then, basically, kind of by chance, I met Rogan and kind of just rampaged on him really about it. This is what's happening, man. Chemical incarceration. Listen to this. He was like, holy shit, can you do a podcast? He was kind enough to let me on. And I came on halfway through with Nick DiPaolo, and it was a wonderful time, but I was fierce with it, man. I was angry, I was mad, and I was cognitively rampaging my ass off. And I generalized, right? I made a couple statements about self-harm, you know, Suboxone treatment, et cetera, generalized.
Yeah, okay.
But it was more of this is all that's happening, and no one is noticing. And that's when it got a little bigger, but got worse, too, because, like I said, it was 24 hours before I even was on that show, after I was on the show. Both of the therapist jobs that I had in Orlando let me go. I was fired the next day.
Wow, that is not surprising, really, when you think about it. But it's funny because you said a couple things there that just resonate with me so clearly. You know, one is addictions. You know, I battled. Well, I don't want to call. Look, I'll call it alcoholism, but it was really, you know, it was really trying to cope with trauma. But the options for me, how I saw them, were so limited. I would go to a 12-step, you know, I went to AA a few times trying to get over this, and I would sit there and go, and this is not for me. But then it seemed like the only alternative. So I would walk out of there, you know, am I not participating in this because I'm rationalizing my own behavior, and should I go back there? And I would go back and I would sit there through that. And then I hear on the radio, I remember listening to a podcast one time and saying, yeah, the efficacy of AA is really no different than quitting cold turkey. It's like, how the fuck is that possible? Right.
2%.
So, yeah. And then the other one was when you talked about, you know, how just our beliefs, I guess, form our perception of the world, or how we choose to look at the world or whatever. Like, I had the idea of quitting alcohol. I created these fears about that were so ingrained in me. Like, and it's everything from I'm not going to know how to socialize to, if I admit that I have a problem with alcohol, then everybody will know that I'm a fucking liar. Right? Because I've said so many times to people that I don't have a problem. And all these fears, it was easier to keep drinking. And then I stopped eventually, and none of those fears came true. And I thought that was when, you know, you talked about, you were talking about chemical incarceration, but I mean, I was in a prison of my own making, right? And that realization, and I was in my 40s, man, and I was like, holy shit, what else am I making up here? You know, and really ever since that moment has been a sort of a voyage of discovery to realize I had a lot of self-limiting beliefs that I was dragging around with me.
Well, it shapes our narrative, right? We like the story that we're telling. You know, I used to tell people in my group, if I handed you a microphone right now and you stood up and you had to tell me your story, what would it be? Would it be a drama, a horror story? Would it be the epic, heroic venture story? What would it be? And We get in that mind frame, like, this is who I am. And that's the phrase I write in the book that I say I hate, is when you hear someone say, that's just who I am. I hear, I'm too naive enough to grow and change, so I've concreted myself into this is who I am. And this is my story, right? That's what resonates with us. It matches our inner dialogue, right? And being able to question that. You mentioned a couple things about AA, man, and, you know, I have been known to attack AA pretty bad when I first came out, and that's kind of unfair to AA for a few reasons for me now that I'm older in this journey. But it's because AA was the guinea pig to study, of which I was. I was using that tool. So, of course, it's filled with holes because that's what I was looking at, right? It was what sure. I was told to use either early in my life going through or later. So it, unfortunately, was what began the diagnosis or the diagnosis. I got to rip it apart. So in ripping it apart to find its holes, to find where science doesn't back it. But all that said in jest, I'm a fan of whatever works. Whatever works for you, I used to say, if somersaults work for you, then do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of veered away from bashing AA because at least it was something, right? And now you could argue that it's actually bad for some people too, but it also helps people too, right? Just like medication, mm-hmm. etc. So, you know, what I've been doing now is I don't like to just bitch without offering solutions, right? So I felt when I was rampaging about this corrupt chemical incarceration system, and now, brother, it goes beyond that. It's not just addiction treatment. It's mental health, period. And it's diagnosis, period. When they rewrote the DSM to come out with the DSM-5, it changed the game. The 5 just eliminated the axes and added severity levels, etc. Essentially, it made more of us be able to qualify for prescription intervention is what it did. They widened the spectrums on most of them, depression, but they didn't do it on ADHD. They actually shortened the spectrums on childhood ADHD, which made everybody happy. But it didn't matter because teachers were already diagnosing ADHD at the time anyway. So the plague had already started. And then they just increased it. And I'm reading on how we're supposed to diagnose. And I'm going, the subjectivity that we're using here, the patient report that we're using here. And, yeah, we do an interview about their environment. But we don't ever change it. We don't go into it. We don't affect it, right? So for me, transrational structured behavior theory was my solution to the bullshit I was watching in mental health application and addiction and anywhere else, depression, anxiety, etc. And so the solution here, too, is what I try to offer more as ideas on the back end is go into the people's lives, right, rather than this go to rehab 30 days or you're depressed and go see a therapist weekly, right? Going into their lives, helping them restructure everything. They're not only their thinking, their thoughts, their feelings, going through all these ideas, but then helping them structure their social environments, the people, the places, the things, and work that avenue. I bet in the long run, what you end up having, addiction treatment gets cut in half rather than somebody treating it for 20 years under the same routine, doing the same things, expecting different results, and going in their homes. It may be longer, maybe 6 months, a year, who knows? But that short amount of time saves so much money on the long run. It saves so many more lives, and it's a way to start backing out of this magic pill idea, this chemical incarceration. This, and what's bad too, man, is sometimes they show up going, hey, don't you have a pill for bipolar? You know, and well, we have a theory. We got a couple ideas, right? Or someone goes, hey, can't you, you know, they scan my brain. They told me I had depression. I can see it. And none of that's provable. I mean, there's a few ways coming out now, but it's still so open to diagnosing, and it was just over-diagnosing. We just needed more solutions, man. I'm going on a cognitive rampage, bro. And
please feel free.
That's kind of where it birthed, right? Not only just standing up, holding a sign, going, hey, this is fucked up. People are dying. AA has about a 2% recovery rate, but we keep applying it over and over and over again, and nobody's changing anything. Everybody's kind of happy, right? The facilities are getting money. The insurance companies are adjusting the pay schedule. Everyone gets their pills. No one's saying nothing, but nobody's getting better. And, you know, we have more pills, but more of an epidemic, right? We have more diagnosis and more treatments for them pill-related. And it needed a change. But offering solutions, I think, is also important. Not just saying, hey, here's corruption. Hey, here's a problem. But here's a new way, right? My hat says there's no bad ideas. So that would be the ideas. Open it all up. End the war on drugs, for one. And open it all up. I don't care if it's psychedelic treatment, ecstasy treatment that MAPS and these wonderful organizations are doing. Open it up. Have AA, have NA, have TA, SA, have all the A's. I don't care. But open the ideas up to where mental health is just easily accessible, not managed by insurance companies and what they say in 30 days or what's diagnosable, what's billable. Open it all up, man. The money you save from not incarcerating people on this, you can apply. The markets that gain from open drug use, man, there's so many misconceptions about drugs, too, that people get crazy about. Dr. Carl Hart says it so much. You know, we know about the 15 percenters that are using heroin, these other things. You know, Dr. Gabor Mate, he backs the idea up with trauma theory and social implications that, man, if we can change people's social implications, connect them, and deal with those traumas, you know, there's so many new ways, brother. And we're still shooting the old cap gun, man. That's all we're doing.
Adam, when, I just want to jump back to something for a sec, Adam. So you mentioned you do Rogan's show, you know, you get on the air, you get this massive audience, you know, influential audience. You come back to your gigs and they show you the door. Were you pissed off at that? Or did that just reinforce to you that you were onto something? It appeared to be something that, you know, the old guard was afraid of. And in your mind, hey, this seems like something that's got people running scared. So it must be good. What was your take on that when they basically showed you the door?
Yeah, I kept the, I went up to like the VP of one of the groups. They had the hiring lady call me and I went all the way up to him and I kept him on the phone for about 10, 15 minutes, getting him to just admit why he was doing it. He said, we had a problem with the paperwork. And, I'm like, man, we've done 3 interviews. We signed the pay. It's a wrap. What do you mean you had a problem with the paperwork? Yeah, we lost this and we had already hired a therapist. He was just full of shit. And I just kept going round and round with him. Like, so why is that? He wouldn't even say it, man. And I thought, like you said, I went, okay, all right, motherfuckers. That's how it's going to be. I'm like, all right, that's how it's going to be, right? I'm out here trying to help people. I love the shit out of people. They're dying. I'm not saying anybody's guilty, but I'm just saying we can change it. And that's what we're going to do. You're going to take away something that cost me near $100,000 in student loans to go help somebody and do this. And not only. Yeah, brother, I'll go off again, but it pissed me off. And I was like, okay, then we're going to really talk about this then.
Yeah. Good for you, man. You know, it's funny. You were talking about, really looking at a person's life and their whole environment. So I read this really good meme the other day and it said, before accepting a diagnosis of depression, make sure that you've eliminated the assholes from your life.
Yeah. Yeah, we're quick to put labels on it, you know, and I don't want to, you know, I've also accused many times of downplaying the seriousness of things, right, and and talking about being able to make changes, but there's no doubt that when you're involved with depression, anxiety, these things can, I mean, people in their lives, right, these are serious approaches, which was why the Rampage was so much more strong, right? It was going, look, I'm not downplaying the fact that you're struggling and you think the pills work, or maybe they do, some do for some people, but the idea of going, you can change that, right? There can be more because of how bad I know it gets for those people is why I think I was so intense with getting the message across.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I'll probably talk about this on a lot of podcasts, but it's because everybody's going to have a different point of view on it. But my wife, you know, my first wife had suffered horrific childhood trauma as a kid and all of that, and had a history of mental illness as a result, bulimia, and, you know, a lot of things that are very common as a result of dealing with that horrific trauma as a kid. And when she started, you know, I guess went off the rails after the birth of our second daughter. She was diagnosed with bipolar disorder after a 30-minute conversation with a psychiatrist. No questions whatsoever about her past. She was medicated and she carried that label to her grave, man. And I'm just realizing within the last, it's that happened 7 years ago, her death. And I'm just realizing in probably the last 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks after starting this group and doing this podcast and talking to people like you, that she could actually still be alive, man.
I did not know that about you, man.
Yeah.
No wonder the Rampage, man. I'm sorry about your loss there, brother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's good, man. That's okay.
I can see your fight, man. Shit. I feel like I'm like a Spartan on the wall with you, man. I'm like, yeah, I would venture to say that because, you know, certain practitioners have what they call silver bullets, if you will, for bipolar, right? You use this pill mixed with this pill. But 30 minutes, man, and to lay down a label like that, I mean, if you ask me, one day that shit should be illegal. You know, because that has disability implications now. So you collect checks for that. And I mean, it's such a rare diagnosis and people don't really understand how rare that really is. And how extremes those can be. But once you start 30 minutes, come on. I mean, 30 minutes and you're throwing out that label to somebody and you know nothing about nothing. And that's an issue, brother. That is a big, big issue.
Yeah, you know, Brian actually has, he's got a really interesting story too, but just to recap it quickly, you know, he's a police officer here in Canada, and he had a really horrific incident and battled, post-traumatic stress, PTSD for like 7 years. I mean, what are your thoughts around that? Do you deal with that at all?
Yeah, PTSD, now I'll link to Gabor Mate's idea of trauma theory and how we all experience the trauma and how we process that. And what's hard when you're dealing, I saw tons of PTSD because when you're in addiction, I also did community mental health, et cetera, but those early years of addiction, trauma for the most part was linked somewhere along the line, but it became, for some people, the trauma would show first and then the drug use later. For some people, traumas came during the drug use. So it's hard to separate, you know, the, which came first at, for certain people, but a majority of the people I talked to were dealing with that on some level. And the idea that, you know, PTSD is, and when you deal with it, is the idea it can be very subjective because the idea of what we label a trauma or what we call life can be very open, right? So I don't think certain people's traumas are, can be compared, right? That someone may experience what they call a trauma and it's nothing to them, right? If you've experienced war or something like that, gunshots and gunfire, then a trauma to someone breaking in your house and you never see them, they just, you knew they were in there. These are different levels of trauma, but to that person, it's that dramatic, it's that intense, it's that impactful. And in treating trauma, social connection is a huge influence in trying to deal with that. And it's on the, you see two things on the rise, or the three on the rise, is PTSD you see due to all the veterans, the police force, even firefighters, paramedics, etc. You see a rise of PTSD and anxiety and depression. It's, I mean, I don't want to say epidemic or anything like that, but it's, you see it more. I think our world is changing so much that good luck trying not to be traumatized. You know, good luck trying not to be ADHD in the next 5 to 10 years with the stimulation that we have and the less mm-hmm. we leave the outdoors, you know?
Adam, do you think those labels, and I guess it sort of pertains to what Jason mentioned after, you know, his wife's, you know, 30 minutes or it's free analysis. Do you think those labels get thrown around far too quickly?
Oh, they're misused, like the word love you, man. I mean, they're so misused. It's, I mean, you hear people just nonchalantly say it. They go like, oh man, my friend, he's so bipolar. You know, he is, da da da. And I challenge them now. When I hear people say that, I look at it and I go, okay, tell me the symptoms. What's it like? Oh, well, one minute he's just real happy and real excited. And then the next minute he's really depressed. And I said, and this happens in like what intervals? An hour, 2 hours? Like, yeah, it'd be an hour or two, right? And I said, well, he's not bipolar. That's not how this works, sir. And when you try to explain to people, do you know what manic really fucking means, man? It's not that you're excited. It's that you're painting your house purple because you had an idea at 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And it's engaging in risky sexual behavior that is very risky, like picking up a prostitute in the worst part of the town and not using protection over and over, right? I mean, these are the choices. That is manic. I mean, Leo told me sometimes the most dangerous diagnosis is a bipolar severe bipolar disorder and a manic episode. That becomes the most dangerous mental health diagnosis. Not a lot of other ones people think of. I think I answered the question probably 40 times, huh?
Yes, you did a good job, man.
Well, we throw them around. We self-diagnose. You hear people because they're a little busy go, oh, I'm ADHD. I'm like, man, that is a serious, serious diagnosis if it's truly present. And we're giving 6-year-olds meth. You know, we're throwing 7, 8, 9-year-olds on methamphetamine, which is what Adderall is, minus a molecule. And we just throw it out there. Teachers, man, teachers have no business dropping that label or any label out there. I challenged on one video I did, I think I said that if a family practitioner doctor prescribes you an antidepressant that he is practicing out of his scope of medicine, I can't go be a surgeon now. I can't just go start doing surgery on people because I think it's a good idea or I read the pamphlet, because they didn't take psychology courses. They had an intro maybe, but he's sitting there. He talks to you for 7 minutes and now he's determined that you're depressed in 7 minutes with no class, no training, maybe some pamphlet and some continued education credits. But outside of that, no, you can't do that. But yet that's where the pills are coming from. That's where the labels start. They start in the classroom. They start when parents start Googling shit You know, I say it in my book, there's a difference between looking up stuff to prove you don't have it rather than looking up stuff to see if you do. So, you know, as you're Googling to go, oh, I have that, look up to prove you don't have it first. Take that angle if you even must look anything up, right? But, yeah, we throw those labels around and they're detrimental to people's lives. But on the other hand, if that's what you're dealing with, then it can allow better systematic targeted approaches to help that if you're truly dealing with that. So if it's that, these labels can be helpful. I know when I experienced some levels of anxiety, some bouts with anxiety, the day I went out of the denial phase and was like, all right, this is what the fuck I'm dealing with. Okay, I know how to do this then. This is what I got to do. You face it head on, right? Then you work on it. For some people, I think when you try to run from it, denial can be destructive, right? Running from the labels.
So let me ask you a question, because what I wonder is, from my own experience, I would suspect this is pretty common, but especially for guys, I think, you know, we're not supposed to show our emotions or and sometimes even admit we have them and all that. And I think I was like that for a long time. And how common is it, do you think, that people have a hard time coping with, say, anxiety because they refuse to admit, I'm not sure how to word this question, but I had a hard time admitting that I felt anxiety. So I never faced it head on. I just did things to self-soothe it, you know, like drinking, and everybody else has different things. But I wonder sometimes how much anxiety is part of a normal life versus how often is it like a bubbling over or an explosion of things you're trying to repress. You know what I mean? Like I don't know how, and say if you're in a healthy, regular, you know, quote, normal life, does anxiety really play a role in it? Or what purpose does it serve?
Well, I mean, it's the fear response, right? It's the idea of fight, flight, or freeze. So it has its biological, you know, roots and evolutionary, right? But we're not sitting around campfires avoiding, you know, lions and saber tooths, et cetera. So we don't have those. We still have the response mechanisms, and they're in there. But now they've become psychological, right? Am I sick? Will I be rich enough? Will I be okay, right? All these ideas that bring anxiety into play. Now, the technical term of when it crosses over as being an issue is when it affects what's called your biopsychosocial. So when it affects your biology, your social connection, your cognitive functioning, when it's doing that, then we can begin to classify something technically as a disorder, if you will, like anxiety or fear. So anxiety, man, I used to say, give me depression all day because I don't want to deal with anxiety. You know, depression, and some people with depression would say no, but they, a lot of times they go hand in hand. They cross over, and as many mental health diagnoses, if you will, do, they share traits and different aspects that match. So anxiety, I think once it begins to affect your biopsychosocial fully, I think then you know that's what you're dealing with, and you can implement tools. You know, what you were talking about, I had a guy on the podcast named Barry McDonough. He's the author of DARE, A New Way to, I think it's a new way to break out of anxiety and panic attacks. But great guy. He called it white knuckling. That's what he was doing with his anxiety, was just gritting his teeth, white knuckling through it, like the shit's not there. I'm just going to be busy, just going to do this. And, you know, until you can finally purge that, right, and let it go. You were talking about how, you know, men can't really, aren't encouraged to expose those weaknesses, to be vulnerable, to show that, you know, hey, I'm dealing with life too. And I think women face it almost as hard now, because now women have this pitch, right? If they got to be tough, strong, and match that, right? So I think everybody faces that idea these days of the white knuckling. We just get it through. We don't tell anybody. And you mentioned it, dude. I reference it a lot. That buildup. That purging, like the sewer cap is like rumbling like this, like it's ready to explode, like, you know, the geyser's about to go, and we hold it down. And that's generally what happens, man. People hold that down, they fight it, they deny it, they don't face it. And then you have a really bad choice one day, you know, something just sets you off, and that's not good. You know, that constant state of purging, I used to say, is necessary.
Adam, do you, you made an interesting point there a couple seconds ago. Do you find a big difference in how the respective genders deal, I guess, both superficially and more on a deeper level with mental health issues? Or is that simply too broad to answer?
Oh, I'll go ahead and take the bullets. It's generally speaking, like, I'll be clear, generally speaking, right? What you do see where men are less likely to admit what they're dealing with on a mental health level. That's generally speaking, there's some research that comes behind some of that, right? But we're not interviewing everybody. Women are more likely to admit what's going on. Maybe that's because they're more in tune or something. Maybe social influence over our generation still has that hold back, right? But the way they approach them too, I used to notice a lot of times you would see, and I'm generally speaking again, so before you fire off the emails, people, I know there's opposites, okay? I'm way aware of that. But you'll see a woman get really analytical. You'll see them break it down, take it slow, purge much more often. You'll see the crying more often or a way to get that out, which to me is a strength, really, is being able to let that go, not holding it. And rather, you'll see guys and men walking in with this, I'm going to beat this thing's ass, or there's nothing wrong with me. I don't trust you doctors. You know. I know I've been hospitalized 4 times. My liver's failing, and I've been to prison the last, 2 years, but I'm fine, right? And you get that hardcore denial first, and then you get that attack mode that, all right, I'm going to beat this shit. I'm going to beat it up. And you can't necessarily beat up depression. You know, you can't do that. Right. And that's why on the left side, man, on how they deal with it is in that denial. What you get a lot of times are people referenced as saying like, I am depressed, you know, or I am an alcoholic. We call ourselves those things, and that shit becomes so powerful. But you never see anybody walking around saying like, I am headache, right? Nobody's like, oh man, I'm a headache. We don't. And being able to separate what's affecting you. You know, I tell a story in the book that if we were all standing around and some big bully starts beating up on a little kid, are we going to be mad at the little kid? No. So right. The bully is the mental health disorder, is what you're dealing with, right? So rather than saying, hey, I am depressed, or I am anxious, or I am bipolar, or I am an addict, that simple dialogue beginning of I'm being affected by depression, I'm being affected by addiction, right? I'm being affected by those things, I'm not those things. We are the little kid in that scenario.
So that's a really interesting point, actually. And why do you think that is? Because you also wouldn't say I'm cancer. I mean,
right.
So is it because there's a belief that it affects your mind, and therefore why I'm not even sure how that even became a way of describing it. So
yeah, I think it opens to it's not my fault. It's not my fault. It's not. No, I have depression. I have cancer. So it's not my fault. You know, so I think a lot of that time is letting go of. Look, it's hard, man. I drop some shit. I call it kicking your front door psychology. I say things that I don't know, maybe get people out of their seat and mad. But, you know, the idea of being willing to question what we've experienced, right, is being able to go, hey, I may be affected by depression right now, but I'm going to make those changes. But it feels better to say, hey, it's not my fault. I have depression. Oh, you don't know my life. You don't know what I've been through. You don't know what I've seen. That's what I would get a lot of times in addiction treatment when I'm saying, look, you can change your thoughts, right? I would tell people, look, there is no truth, right? There's just no truth in our physical conscious world anyway. And I use the reference that if they ride a roller coaster and they said it wasn't fair or it wasn't scary, I then ride the roller coaster and say it was the scariest ride of my life. Who's telling the truth? Well, we both are, right? So once they realize, and I can say, see, if that's truth, as we want to change it as whatever my perception is, we have that right. So whatever you're saying is your traumatic story of why you should be depressed, right? That's shooting all over yourself is what I would call it. And Leo calls it. That idea is, well, you must be, right? Here's the story again, right? They got their microphone telling their dramatic story. And then I was, and then I was, and then this happened to me, and then I was. And this becomes the narrative of my life, and it matches. But guess what I've learned? Hey, it's not my fault. I am an addict. I have a brain disease, or I am depressed, or I am bipolar. And then it matches my story, and for the most part, it relieves any responsibility of control of what we can do.
Now, that's a really good point, because when I first started to try to ask you that question, I was thinking, why would, say, the medical community or whatever professionals want to label that way. But I think in some ways it serves the quote patient. It's like not a warm blanket. That's a terrible way of putting it, but it is a way of allowing ourselves to be absolved of responsibility and place the onus on healing and getting better or management of symptoms into the hands of somebody else. And that's basically how our entire medical system is structured, really, when you think about it, right? That's, I never thought about it that way, which is why I love having these conversations.
Yeah, we have a system, we treat symptoms. That's what we do, right? Insurance won't even pay for your preventative checkup. God forbid you just want to get your blood tested just to make sure you're doing okay. No, you're coming out of pocket. Oh, you want to prevent yourself from being sick? No, no, no. That's not how we do it in the United States. You have to be depressed before we let you see a counselor. You have to be sick before we let you go to that doctor. It's all reactive in nature. And I get the approach. I know why we need the label so we can research better methods, whether that is a pill approach one day, whether that is brain scans that can actually show that, see, we've proven it, that this area means this, which none of that can do these right now, currently. And I get it. So we need the labels, right? I mean, the guy who created stress was just a thing. The guy named it. I forget when he did the research. But he was studying this effect, so we called it stress, so he could study it. So there's effective reasons of why we have the labels on a research method, how we treat it, how we approach it, for sure, right? I mean, definitely. But when we treat the symptoms of this idea, and it's a collective, subjective base, I mean, walk you from the beginning. If you walk into the reactive nature of mental health, it's, I'm now feeling depressed. I go see my doctor first. The doctor then goes, hey, here's some antidepressants. We're not sure. It's a roll of the dice. You may want to hang yourself. But hey, you've been sad for a little bit and you told me in 7 minutes, but here's your pill. You go home. But they will tell you, I suggest that you talk to someone too. Now see a counselor or a psychologist. Your insurance is going to cover most of it anyway, and it's going to be expensive. And they just took a shot to left field. They cut 30% of their income now, all psychologists and mental health counselors. But then you go and you show up there, and now they tell you, here's a label. More than likely, they're going to just manage your prescription medications as well. And you're going to get a diagnosis, and then let's treat these symptoms that we have. I feel like this, so let's treat the symptoms. Let's change the brain around. Maybe this one will work, right? So you have a theoretical, subjective patient report diagnosis, which can't be proven on any scientific level whatsoever from the beginning. Then we're going to hand you theoretical pills based on some pretty good studies on this may help for you. And go talk to somebody once a week, theoretically.
Bam. Well, man, these cognitive rampages, I could get speaking of addiction, I think I'm addicted to your cognitive rampages, man. How's that for irony?
We all go off on them, man. We all have them. You know, that's why I have the guests on, because my intention really, it's such a challenge for me. I write a lot about being uncomfortable. It's where the change is, et cetera. And so for me to shut my crazy mouth that I talk too much with on my show is hard for me. So. But I know they're smarter than me, so the challenge during my entire show is for me not to talk and really just listen and come out at the end of it, because they release their cognitive rampage, right? I try to poke around. I start like a therapist, lay on the couch, tell me about your childhood, right? Then we walk them in. I get tons of, hey, I've never told that story, you know, and then eventually I find that way to extract that marrow in their mind and get that out there to where you hit that button and then you hit that switch, right? He says, but every now and then you hit that switch. And then by the end of it, that's usually where I end the podcast, right, is when I really noticed that they just went off and they just released their cognitive rampage, is what I say.
Awesome. So, hey, let's talk about transrational structural behavior theory, because from what I understand from, you know, reading on your website and talking to you, it's an approach that is broader than just mental health issues. It's an approach for, you call it self-discovery, change, and life optimization. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I still laugh sometimes on how I came up with TSBT. Just being an Albert Ellis fan, I think I went to my own RABT thing. And so the transrational word I kind of put together, I made that word up. And the idea is to transcend into rational thinking through belief excavation. So we all understand the idea of reframing, right? That we can go, hey, this is a bad day. No, today's a good day, right? We get the influence of reframing, but it helps in the moment, but that doesn't matter in our lives. So we have to go deep into our beliefs, what I call core beliefs. And that's the first principle of change in the book, is the idea of what do you believe about self, others, and the world? And write that down in one sentence and then study that. See how rational that really is. See how negative those three core beliefs, right? So the idea of transrational is helping the person change by examining their own dialogue, their own self-talk, and their own beliefs, and then rationally observing those, and then being willing to change those to transrational, to transcend into a rational state of thinking and processing information.
I'll keep rolling. And then, well, hold on. I have a question.
Yeah.
Sorry, I wanted to jump in there. So what is rational?
Oh, the I love the philosophical argument of the rational versus irrational, right? It can be led to such the perception of what we take from it, but I look at it on spectrums, right? The idea of irrational being something that we tend to awfulize or overdo, right? So in language, we tend to say things something like, you always do this to me, or I'm never going to get better, right? So we use already always, you do this always is like 86,000 something seconds in a day. I'd have to do it that much to you to always do it to you, right? Or never do it, right? So eventually we do. So we use dialogue to create this irrational mind to awfulize how we think we should feel, if that makes sense. So something happens to us, right? You know what? I'll use Albert Ellis's ABCs to kind of explain the idea, right? ABCs for him, meaning there's an activating event. Based on that activating event, we have a belief, right? Based on that belief is our consequence on our actions that we respond to. I used to do it in a group to where imagine a guy's walking down the street. He bumps into your shoulder, activating belief or the action. And based on that, if I have a belief that he disrespected me, I'm a man, how dare he? He should apologize to me. Based on that belief, and I turn around, what might be my activating or my behavior, my consequence? I may yell at him, fight him, who knows, based on that belief. But if I'm willing to then challenge what I believe, I'm walking down the street, A happens, activating event. My belief is, hey, maybe he's late. Maybe he's late to a funeral. Then I turn around. How's my consequence then? What's my outcome of behavior? So observing the rational versus irrational is about going into what we believe and being able to question that. Based on this, though, like I said in the beginning, we know there is no truth. If we know there is no truth, then everything we've ever experienced and everything we believe is up to our own perception control. That we were like fucking wizards. It's awesome. It's like a magic thing that we all have. I did a video called Your Superpower. Your superpower is literally to say, that is an experience I went through. This is what I guess I'm supposed to feel like because of that, or they told me, or that's what it is. But I'm going to change that perception, and I'm going to make it this is what happened to me. It's why somebody that can go through, come from a really bad childhood, they use that to catapult them, right? It doesn't become a cancer. While someone else can just keep telling that story, this is how I should be based on that. And they keep telling it, and it becomes the cancer to them. That's literally the superpower you all have, and it starts within the beliefs, within the dialogue, being willing to confront the irrational versus the rational in our own minds and what we believe, which is hard to do because those beliefs come from what we've experienced, right? And, you know, I rode the roller coaster. You can't tell me that shit ain't scary. I was there. So being willing to question all of that experience, what we've been through, what we know, what we don't know, our traumas, being willing to question those perceptions as being whatever reality we want to make them, that's the power of the dialogue. That's why I opened the book with Transrational, is to begin the change cognitively, beginning with what you believe about world, others, and self. When you can start those, every belief else, whether you're a Miami Dolphins fan or like eggplant, all filters through one of those three beliefs, everything. So if you're walking around, but we respond quickly, right? We do so many actions in one motion of what we observe, what we see, what we think. So we categorize it, and our brain has learned to move. So we have these concrete beliefs. I don't like people. The world is corrupt. I'm cool as shit. So we walk around with these three beliefs. And then anytime someone challenges any one of those beliefs on any level, we're coming at them. And if everything we believe is filtered through at least two out of three negative beliefs, well, then what do I believe about most of the world, others, and eventually myself, right? Those are the corruptible beliefs. But so examining those from on a real level, a cognitive scientific level, a going into our dialogue, going into our thoughts, knowing that's kind of the first principle of change. That there's three principles of change in the beginning, but you learn the principles, and there's two tools that you apply. Using those tools, you create a new life based on your beliefs. I'm not a smart enough guy to write a 1, 2, 3, 4 step book of how you're supposed to do life and beat mental health. No one can do that. What I did was present the scientific implications. Here's the framework. Now, based on what you believe, you answer questions, you fill in activities, you reveal your actual own life philosophy, because I walk through people on how to make decisions differently, stop making to-do lists, quit making the to-do list, right, and operate on a philosophy. It'll give you the choice that you should make to reduce guilt, regret, and shame, walking through making decisions, and then restructuring your whole life. And then you do that at the end. So there's behavioral implications, behavioral science methods and research worked into the decisions and framework you build throughout the whole book. It comes in biologically, on many levels. I call them components to change. So you apply the first tool to change, which is rational self-analysis, which is how you help. That's teaching you rational versus irrational, but walking you through it, not just changing what you think, which reframing does, but changing how you think, because it's linked to the beliefs. Once we start changing that, we develop a new way to make decisions by cultivating our life philosophy and 10 different components in our lives, revealing those philosophies, literally having a 15-sentence philosophy that is yours in front of you to make new decisions, and then applying that in your behavior routine with your people, places, and things, while cultivating new discoveries about self, about world, and others, uncovering new passions, and just questioning and walking again, becoming that curious child once again in our own lives, right? And then being able to question it all from the beginning and even question what you cultivate all the way at the end.
That, I love it. So much I want to say about that. I know we're getting close to the end of time. God, I could talk to you all day, man. Brian? Fun. Sorry, go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say, I love the way you summed it up at the end and say, basically, become that curious child again. Like that, I find that it's almost so simple. It sounds so simple, yet it's really not, because when you think back to when you were a kid, you had no preconceived notions about anything, right? The world was just about discovery. The world was about, oh, look, a frog is green. Right? Or, right. Hey, look, oh, sugar is sweet. Or, ooh, this dish soap under the sink tastes like, you know, yuck. And as you grow, you lose that sense of wonder. You lose that sense of discovery. Everything, like you said, Adam, is either rational or irrational. There's no middle ground. That's really sticking with me, that become that curious kid again. I think that's fantastic.
I appreciate it. And that's the structure of applying, right? So the transrational, then the structure is looking at the structure, then applying that structure, not on what I'm telling you is best, but what you believe is best and what you've now deciphered as being rational through the cognitive sciences. And then when you structure a routine or ideas and environments, people, places, and thing, that's the structure of it. And so transrational structure, behavior. Now we do the behaviors. Now we live the routines. Now we do those new activities. Now we cultivate those new passions and seek and being able to question those, right? It's like somewhere along the line, right? We went, all right, I know how the world works. It's corrupt. I've now decided, everyone is not to be trusted and the world is bad and against me, right? Life isn't fair. Life should be fair, right? As Albert Ellis says, you should treat me fairly and life should be fair are the two most irrational beliefs many hold dear.
So
sadly, that's true.
Let me ask you a question, because how difficult is it to convince people when you're working with them that how they are experiencing the world is not the objective truth, right? That must be a hard thing for people to wrap their minds around. And I wanted to ask you a follow-up question to that too, which is what are your thoughts around the idea that how we create how we look at the world influences what we create in our world? Because I think a lot of people think that things happen to them when in so many ways they are actually creating them without even knowing it. And I don't really understand how that mechanism really works, but I'd love to know if you have any thoughts about it.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could answer how much of a percentage is the epigenetic effect, right? But we're learning more and more with science. I talk about in the book a lot about science in there, because I got to say, look, I'm not this naive. So I list a lot of competence creators, et cetera. I actually quote Jason Silva at length in there in his idea of the epigenetic influence, that it does have an effect, right? And our environment, we know, but also what we believe has an effect. There's that nature and nurture argument. But for the world that we build, I write about it in my book, actually, for the mental health related and the world that we create around us, I talk about them and I call them early life victories. So we all have early life victories somewhere. It doesn't matter at what level, but we have them. And we develop tools and we learn those tools, mental health, behavior related, et cetera, when we've had those victories, right? So we have early life victories because of these tools. Then we use those tools continuously, what kind of friends we make, how we do it, how we handle people, et cetera. And then when we get older, what we do, we operate with those same tools. So what we end up doing is building the same environment around us that we came from, and act like we don't want to be around that environment anymore, right? And I'll use myself as an example. I was raised in, let's just say, a violent home. It was fearful all the time and some physical abuse, et cetera. But outside of that, some good things too came out of the home, but I was hyper vigilant my entire life, all the way as a teenager, and then went into other lives, if you will. And I ended up building a life of a drug dealing gangster, if you will, and thought, hey, this is what I'm supposed to do, right? And so my tools work there. The acting like I was the shit, acting like I had all figured out, being so selfish to where I said, I'm just going to get some money. I don't care who I rip off, who I rob, whatever I got to do, right? And so those same early life victories, because, hey, I survived that childhood abuse, right? I survived that shit. So these tools must fucking work. And if these tools don't work, it must be you. So not willing to question those tools and look at why we have such tools, why we use those, and then we apply them in our lives. It's why a lot of kids that come from abusive relationships end up being abusive fathers and mothers, or they get an abusive loving relationships, right? They match that. People match what they've come from, wondering, wait, this is never what I wanted to be a part of. It's because the tools you use to survive them work in the world you built around you, but are you willing to question your own choices and beliefs of why you do them?
Interesting. So we've had you for over an hour here. I could go on forever, so I think we should wrap it up. And one question I wanted to ask you is, knowing what you know and with the skills that you've developed, how do you resolve a moral dilemma when you're faced with one?
Well, for me, it's my life philosophy. That's actually easily done for me. And it is for anybody else, actually, is when we stop making lists, when we stop the – look, all depression, anxiety, not all. I say a lot of it comes when we have a toil, when there's a choice to be made, when I got to do A or I got to do B. And then we have to create this. So we start making lists. We start chatting with friends. We start asking mom. We're like, you know, oh, grandfather, let me sit with you. Give me some wisdom, right? We're even asking our kids sometimes, right? We don't even know what to do. And the more we study it, the more we're looking behind the glitter and the possibilities of what choice A could be and choice B could be. We're just making our lives more miserable by knowing all the good things, all the pros and cons. Now I know it's too much choice. Malcolm Gladwell writes a lot about having too much choice as being an issue. And so for me, I mean, I screw up too, to where I'm like, all right, this is this choice, this is not, let me toil about it. But then you got to remember is in my book too, I help you develop your own life philosophy and not, and I specifically say in the book, not that quote you keep using from somebody else. Because that's not your life philosophy. You didn't write it. You didn't cultivate it. You can't live it or assimilate it. And it damn near may be irrational, too. So you got to be willing to question that shit. But really have your own life philosophy that's from your core beliefs that you've also examined with RSA, which is the tool I teach in the book, making sure that your beliefs are rationally based. And when those beliefs are rationally based, you can have a philosophy for whether or not to eat the Cheetos or to eat the Cheetos or a moral decision, right? And so you can just ask yourself, what do I believe about that? If you don't have a philosophy, if the moral dilemma is, what do I believe about that? Why do I believe that? And then asking why to that a few times till you come up with a base rational philosophy. My philosophy is like, I don't know, 70 pages now, because you can always add to it, right? So for me, and they always start with the word remember. I help people structure their sentence. So the word starts with remember, like you're leaving advice to yourself. Because if you don't listen to your own advice, that's your own ass. So, and we love to listen to ourselves. So in a moral dilemma, I have what I believe about the world, others, and self cultivated right in front of me in my philosophy. And all I do is if I have a choice of a moral dilemma, I look at choice one, I look at choice B, and I ask, what's my philosophy here? And for the most part, I get told exactly what to do. And the hardest part then is really choosing on that, right? That's where the emotions take over. All we're really trying to do in a moral dilemma is get to our wisdom and dilute the emotion. You know, Leo used to tell me, I loved it a lot. He said that, you know, we're great helps, right? We're the best help to our friends. Friends call me for advice all the time. They give me help. And, well, why is that? And so Leo would say, it's that way because, look, we're 70% wisdom, 30% emotional when we're helping somebody else, give or take the emotion of what we're helping them with. So we're coming with pure wisdom, right? So if it's pure wisdom and not emotion, problem is, like he would say, the little rhyme there, he'd say, with all things cool, calm, and benign, I'll solve anyone's problem unless it's mine. Because the figures switch. Now we think we're 70% wisdom because all our friends think we're the shit, but we're 30% wisdom, 70% emotion, and it gets clouded, and then we make lists, then we toil back and forth. And the way that you break through all of the emotions of the bullshit, get down to your wisdom, is through your life philosophy, or I have a very quick fix way to do it too if you don't have your life philosophy. All you have to do is imagine who you love unconditionally. I tell people to imagine your child or your nephew, etc. And if they were asking you what to choose, whatever you would tell them to do is the closest to the truth you'll ever get. And if you don't do what you would advise to them, then you're not listening to yourself and you're setting yourself up for guilt, regret, and shame later. Because the idea is to choose over short-term pain, not long-term pain. If I make the choice, it may hurt because I want it now. It would taste good, or this would be fun. This would be whatever, but that's short term. Now I'm going to have long term pain if I do that. Then the idea is sticking to your philosophies, making the choice based on your truth. And that's how you avoid the emotion in any moral decision.
Well, I think that is a perfect place to leave it. Brian, did you have anything else?
No, just, I mean, obviously, Adam, this is for a lot of people. I mean, well, Jason and I included. This is going to be a real mind bender to sort of rethink how, I mean, in a lot of ways, how you've been raised, how you've learned your morality, how you've learned your thought process. I'm sure there'll be people who'd want to dig into this more. Could you throw out your site, your book, your Facebook, whatever you think would be the best way people could dig up some more of this? Cause I'm sure we're going to have people asking us how they can find out more.
Yeah. It's cognitiverampage.com or adamlowry.com, LOWERY.com. Either one. Even I think the Cognitive Rampage does it, but the book's on Amazon as well, and a Kindle version as well. If you buy the second edition of the book, comes with a free Kindle. You can just search Cognitive Rampage on Amazon. Heck, just Google Cognitive Rampage. And I'm all over. I got videos I do where I talk about small things like this, where I try to not rampage too long. I try to keep it in 2 to 3 minute videos where I'm on YouTube as well. I do Adam's Rampages randomly. The podcast is on iTunes. Yeah. Yeah, just Google any of those stuff. It should be fun.
Sorry, I got to ask you real quick, Adam. Your logo, the elephant head. My totem animal, my spirit animal. The layout is fantastic. You got to see it for yourself, ladies and gents. Could you explain real quick the theory or the chaos behind the elephant head logo?
Love that. Yes, sir. First, all kudos goes to the producer and my good friend and artist behind the Cognitive Rampage. He's been my right hand since Joe. It was funny. I had this garbage website up, and I get basically 24 hours notice for him on Joe Rogan. And he stays up all night trying to make the website look less cheesy with shitty pictures. I didn't have many pictures of myself, but Steve built all that and has been with me for 2 years, and he was the drawer of that. He has a whole comic book series out, Conquest, and a new one coming. But we were thinking elephant. We always worked together. I would ramble, and he would start sketching. And the logo has evolved. When it first came out, it was just the elephant. There were no butterfly ears at all. And we decided that we're going to evolve the logo every year because we change and we evolve. That's what I'm talking about, right, is we're never just who I am, so then we should evolve. And the butterfly ears appeared then first. Now we've since changed that twice with different colors. But for me, you have to be willing to question the impossible, because if one of the world's largest land animals, if you could imagine, could literally fly with one of the most delicate things on the planet, just a pair of butterfly wings, then you can change anything. I say a lot that if you're not willing to question the impossible, then you're planning for the inevitable. So for me, the power, the connectedness to which the elephant represented all in the same time, they're one of the few animals that operate very much like a family. And will help strangers many times and other animals out. They're quite protective. So that was a front for me, that I love that initial impact of the elephant. But he looked a little pissed. And he was kind of like, you know what, I told you not to fuck around with people because people are dying and nobody's listening, so I'm about to rampage on you. And one of the most dangerous things on the planet is when that very gentle creature decides that you are a threat and then decides to rampage at you. You're in trouble. So it encompassed all that for me, is being willing to question the impossible. Because, man, how could you ever imagine that, right? How could you imagine an elephant flying with butterfly wings? That's crazy. Yeah, but could you imagine that trauma you went through really ain't that trauma? You just keep shaping it that way, right? Can we question that? Can we question the impossibilities of what we believe to be impossibilities and make those changes, man? And for me, we're evolving, right? I almost said we're always changing, and that's not true. Ellis would say I'm irrational because one day I'll die. But I guess that's a change then too. So we're changing as long as we're here, as far as we know. And the butterfly wings represent that evolution, that change, and how quick that change can be.
Thanks, man. It's a beautiful image. I think it wraps up your basic message graphically in a way I don't think you could do with words. So kudos to you for that. Thanks for the explanation. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you know, that makes me that makes me feel nothing but shame about the fact that I have this arm sleeve tattoo with all these owls on it, and I got it because I thought it looked cool. Like, that's it. Jesus.
Well, owls actually, and on a native side, I'm part native, and they're the spirit deliverers, the messages of the back and forth. So owls are a beautiful and strong creature that have the ability to cross over to both dimensions, to the spiritual side and to our world here. Now, I'm just saying the legends there, right? So I think the owls are beautiful. And brother, your spirit animal being the elephant man, mine's actually the black bear. My native name is Flaming Bear. But for some reason, the elephant was the one that stuck out. It really fit.
I think it's beautiful.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well, brother man, this was phenomenal. Thank you so much for coming on and giving us your time and just delivering so much value to our audience, man. I really, really appreciate it. And I know I speak for myself and Brian that we're going to follow what you're doing and keep changing lives, man.
Well, I appreciate you that you think I have value. I have my moments, as I like to say, but I would leave everyone with this, that if anything I said affected you as you're listening to this podcast and continue to listen to these mental health warriors, if anything does touch you or impact you, that it wasn't me, that you did the difficult part, which is actually listening. Otherwise, I'm just making noises and movements up here, doing nothing. So if it impacted you, you did that hard part already and heard it and listened, and then we'll do the harder part in applying it as well. Because I love to say that, remember that all humans are all knowing all the time. They just have to be reminded. So at the most part, I'm just reminding you, you did the hard work. You listened. Apply it in your life. And remember, it's only hard if you believe it to be.
Thank you, brother.
Awesome. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
Take care, my friend.
Anytime.
Woo! Man, thank you, Adam, for that conversation, man. I applaud the hell out of you. I love the fact that you were doing what's considered, you know, a traditional type of role in the mental health field, and it wasn't working for you. It wasn't working for your clients and your patients, so you decided to chart your own path and see what else was possible. That's what Mental Health Warriors is all about, and that is obviously what the Cognitive Rampage and Tribe of Change is all about. So, man, you're a brother, you're a hero, and you're a warrior, and it was an honor to have this conversation with you. And I want to leave everybody with the same parting that I leave you with every single week. If you have struggled or know someone who's struggling, I want you to know that I have struggled too. And if you ever want to talk to me, I will not judge you. We'll see you next week, everybody.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode. For more shows and resources, head on over to mentalhealthwarriors.com.